Most Indians are one medical bill away from dipping into poverty. God forbid if something were to happen to them, their dependents are going to be in a whole lot of trouble. And yet, you see this discrepancy when it comes to buying a term insurance plan, because the question always is this: what do I get in return? There are companies that do right by you, as in they do offer you policies that are very robust, high coverage, doesn't have a lot of exclusions, etc. But then there are companies that try to fleece you as well. And you won't know it until you actually show up, you know, one day at the doctor and you realize that my insurance company will only let me share in a shared room. And that is true. If you go and ask people what is the name of the plan, they probably name their insurance company. Some of them can't even name that. They just say a Mediclaim policy. But very few people can name the policy themselves. Forget about the contents of the policy. That's how bad the situation is. That's how dire the situation is.
Through money to be made insurance?
Yeah. It's one of the few financial products where agents can still make money. And a lot of people think they shouldn't be making money, which is a fair point. From a consumer point of view, my agent shouldn't be making the kind of money that they're making right now. And because other financial products, mutual funds, for instance, what do agents make? Pretty much nothing.
Yo, what is up, my friends? Welcome to another episode of Dostcast. My name is Vinamra Kasana, and I am coming to you from Mumbai, where I have taken residence permanently, temporarily. Only time will tell. However, I would like to say today's podcast is with Shrihit Karkera. He is the founder of FinShots and Ditto Insurance. After I had moved to Mumbai, the last few days were spent in absolute chaos, as I was trying to understand where the hell is my stuff, what stuff do I even need, how do I set up a studio, all of that was happening. And in the middle, I got a chance to interview someone arguably who's built the finance writing culture in India and made it available to the masses. FinShots is a very highly subscribed newsletter. I know for a fact, bahut sare high net worth individuals FinShots subscribe karte hain, and I myself have read the newsletter quite a few times. So when I figured I could speak to someone like Shrihit, I was very mesmerized, because my background is in writing. My background is specifically in internet writing. And so in today's podcast, you will learn about the nuances of writing online and how to build a newsletter or even a personal brand using just writing. But more importantly, there is another angle that we cover today, and that is insurance. As a 27-year-old who has just weaned off family health insurance and term insurance, I'm actively looking at options in the market about what insurance to buy. Usually I do podcasts that are sort of wild, crazy, or directly in line with my artistic or aesthetic or cultural interests. But as the biting realities of late adulthood hit me with every passing debit to my bank account, I must think about the future. And I must think about it in a way in which I haven't thought about before. Insurance is just one pillar of that. Now, I don't care if you are in your early 20s or your late 20s or early 30s. It's one of those boring adult things that you must do, insurance that you must acquire, because it makes life easier. Recently, I've had to foot the entire bill for this splint that I keep wearing in my mouth that annoys many people. And my insurance did not cover it. So this conversation I approached from a selfish desire to learn how I can best leverage what is considered to be an essential investment tool, an essential guard against medical tragedy, all of those things. I think what the guys at Ditto are doing is a fantastic job. And because they launched FinShots first, the switch to the insurance market is pretty interesting. It's things you've never heard about before in this context. It's Dostcast giving you tech plus writing plus brutal adult wisdom about what style of insurance to get, or even how to navigate the complex insurance market. Because trust me, the day someone older in your family meets with an unfortunate accident, you will realize the importance of insurance, as I have recently. The episode with Shrihit from Ditto and FinShots begins in 3, 2, 1.
Awesome, man. Shrihit, welcome to Ditto.
Yeah, welcome. I'm glad that...
yeah, thank you for being in my office and making the time to meet me here in my plush studios. How are you, man?
I am pretty good, and I'm glad that you're here. I'm glad that you made the trip to Bangalore, and I'm glad that we're having this conversation as well.
Yeah, man. I'm super happy that the conversation before was so interesting,
yeah.
Because it helped me understand who you are as a person. And I think when I meet most founders, they often too often talk only about their companies and, you know, don't get a chance to fully explore who they are.
Yeah.
I wanted to start off with something. I'm facing a little bit of an issue nowadays.
Right, right, right.
Is I am a creator, like we mentioned.
Right.
There was a whole onslaught of creator economy companies in the pandemic,
mm-hmm.
all preaching that creators who were struggling, had good numbers, had brand deals, could now monetize. They could sell courses, they could sell some kind of memberships.
Yeah.
The odd company would also even mention newsletters, right?
Yeah.
Now, I think there is not everyone who makes good videos can write well, right?
Yeah.
So we're in 2024 now.
Mm-hmm.
India, in my anecdotal opinion, I don't think India has fully pivoted to becoming a newsletter reading class.
Yeah.
But at least in the echelons of Bangalore, I see it in full flow, full
mm-hmm.
steam.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think we're at that point where we will actually pivot completely to newsletters
right.
as a very viable medium for independent people like me
mm.
to build a sizable audience,
mm-hmm.
to stay in touch with that audience,
mm.
and to have some kind of commerce from that?
Yeah, yeah. No, that's an excellent question, you know, because I look at what we did back in 2019, for instance, and we picked newsletters as a medium, and newsletters were completely out of fashion, right? So we didn't say we have a large community. Let's now probably start off a newsletter to get in, you know, to keep in touch with our community. What we simply said is let's start off a newsletter simply to build the community in the first place, which is a terrible idea in the first. I mean, it's horrible because newsletters, A, were completely out of work. And even to this day, I don't think a lot of people actually enjoy newsletters. There's a small subset of people who enjoy newsletters. And in my opinion, there's about 2 or 3 million people in India who are probably going to read like an English newsletter that spans close to 4 or 5 minutes worth of content. That's the target audience. Because I'll tell you, the first 2 years, we scaled from zero subscribers
uh-huh.
to close to 300, 400,000 subscribers. First 2 years.
By virtue of content alone.
Yes, by virtue of content alone.
So this is just like well-written stuff.
This is well-written stuff, but we did have tiny hacks. I'll talk about it. But the earlier point that I was getting at was that once we did that, we realized that we're plateauing. And since then, we've probably added net 100,000 plus subscribers. That's it. We've not added more subscribers. And we right now we add about 1,000, 2,000 subscribers a week.
That's a lot.
It's a lot, but at the scale, you know, we're already at 500,000 subscribers, and now we're adding, you know, 1,000 subscribers a week, and you're also losing 100, 200 subscribers a week. So net, you're probably adding about 800 subscribers a week, which doesn't amount to a lot. I mean, in my business, at least. So newsletter as a business, I don't think there's a lot of money to be made there, even if you're thinking about pivoting to commerce, right? However, there's a subset of people that still believe that the audience that they can build through newsletters alone can garner enough scale to build a small-sized business, which I agree. Mm-hmm. You could probably build a business, you know, with an annual turnover of about 10 crores, right? By leveraging newsletters and probably
alone.
Commerce. Yeah, you could. I think you could, like, really, like, if FinShots ever decided to just monetize the newsletter, not the commerce bit, right? Just the newsletter and really, really pushed, right? We could probably build a 10 crore top line business. That I believe is the cap. Like to get beyond that, I need to have ideas that I don't have right now.
Yeah.
Right? However, getting to that mark, the 100,000, 200,000 subscribers that you spoke of, just by virtue of content alone, it was good content, yes, but it was also a lot of tiny hacks. What are the tiny hacks? For instance, one of the things that we did was we partnered with Zerodha. So Zerodha would automatically send our newsletters to all their audience once a week.
Hmm.
And some of them would subscribe. Now that didn't amount to a lot, right? It amounted to about 10% net subscriber addition, I guess. Uh-huh. 10-15% net subscriber addition. But that's one hack. The second hack we pursued was we realized a lot of the people that were reading our newsletters, because FinShots is a financial newsletter that simplifies one topic every day, 3 minute read. Very easy, very bite-sized, something that a 20, 21-year-old who's constantly running out of time would probably enjoy. So we said, okay, the people that are reading these are in, you know, commerce colleges in India, in arts colleges in India, in finance business classes in India. So let's go there. So we'd go to every college that we could find. We'd find these student body groups, right? So finance club, consulting club, etc. We talk to the POCs and we tell them, listen, how about you send our newsletter out to your people? Because they usually do their newsletters as well. Uh-huh. Most of these people don't want to write those newsletters. So we said, send our newsletters. You can co-brand it. And then if somebody wanted to subscribe, they could probably subscribe to the original newsletter, the FinShots newsletter as well. Uh-huh. So we added about 50, 60,000 subscribers in the first year simply by doing this. Right? So we kept finding these tiny hacks over and over again. At some point, we realized, okay, we need more reach. So one of our HRs at the time, we were a very tiny team. We had about 10, 11 people. And one of the HRs at the time said that, look, we have the newsletter. It's 3-minute read every day. How about I just voice it and we post it as a podcast, right? And I thought it was silly. I thought it was absurd, the idea that you just put this newsletter as a podcast, that it would do any numbers, right? Within the first year, we were in the top 10 Indian podcasts in Spotify. And we are still to this day, I think, on Apple Indian podcasts.
I think you still are in the top 25. I checked the charts a few days ago.
Yeah, on Apple, I think we're number 2 or number 3, if I'm not wrong, right? And that's it. It's the newsletter, him just narrating the newsletter. So we found another hack there. We also found another hack in the sense that back in 2018, 2019, infographics again were out of work. Mm-hmm. Right? Nobody liked it. But we reinvented it. We started putting out infographics and people would share these in other groups. And suddenly people would look at the end, what's this FinShots business? They'd go, they'd see these stories. And even if they wouldn't read it every single day, you know, our read rates weren't exceptional, right? But it's much better than the industry standard. Mm-hmm. Even if they didn't read it, it's like going to the gym.
What's the industry standard?
So the industry standard is about, you know, for newsletters, it's probably, if you're doing 10%, if you're really good, 10% open rates. Right? Okay.
And that's at mass.
Mass scale, right? I mean, if you're a niche newsletter, you'll probably get better, you know, open rates. But we were at 30, 40 in the early days, right? Even now, I think we're about 30, 35, right? Open rates when it comes to, because we generally don't induce people to subscribe, but, you know, using dark patterns, etc. If you really want to subscribe.
Sorry, what's dark patterns?
So dark patterns are clever tricks that developers use on the website to perhaps trick you into doing things that you may not want to do. For instance, let's suppose I go on a website right now on you know, FinShots. Mm-hmm. You have a field. It says, if you want, you can subscribe. And if you subscribe, there's a two-factor authentication.
Sure.
However, if I automatically induced you into subscribing by offering you something for free and saying, hey, look, if you give me your email address, I'm going to send you this PDF for free.
Hey, but, man, it's called a lead magnet and marketers use it all the time.
It is a lead magnet. But let's suppose the subtext there is very tiny. Okay. And there I write, we'll also send you a daily newsletter.
I see.
You're sort of getting it. Yeah. Because you're not telling them that everything is as is. You're just saying that, look, you'll get this, fair enough. That's a lead magnet and then you can probably communicate. But you're also, if you're not telling them, there's also a new daily newsletter I'm going to send to you every single day, right? It's probably not as dark a pattern that I can imagine, but within the context of newsletters, I just...
So you know, how do you think this high transparency helps? Because, you know, I have numerous times I'm following some marketer, right, or some guru that I want that specific 3-pager from, correct, or that one small free PDF from.
Correct.
They don't mention it at all that they're going to send me other stuff, right?
Yeah, yeah.
They usually give me upfront stuff like, okay, you'll get this lead magnet and then maybe one email in case you want. And some have like opt-in, opt-outs.
Yeah.
But then others just like, they send all of their force behind me, right?
Yeah, yeah.
How did this high transparency and just being absolutely value-driven help you out?
Yeah, for instance, let's suppose, you know, Gmail. Like if you're using any service, an email delivery system, right? Mm-hmm. They're going to see how many people actually read your stuff. If a lot of people aren't reading your stuff, right? Eventually, you know, the email delivery system will think that you're just spamming people. Right? So more often than not, your emails end up in spam. So you get lower open rates anyway, right? Your domain is marked down. You're not going to have the, I mean, it's just a vanity metric at that point in time. Right?
So there is also like a vague algorithmic like feature to Gmail as well.
Yes, yes. I mean, in the sense that if, because they have to identify spam, and the way they do it is to make sure that they calculate open rates. If people are subscribing to it genuinely, they want to read it, and they see that not enough people are reading it, it means that you tricked them, you know, probably into subscribing to this service. So then I'm going to mark you down. So then my emails are unlikely to hit your inbox, your primary inbox, probably going to spam, probably going to promotions. Right? So you lose there. You also have to realize that if you're building a true blue service, in the sense that you're not trying to impress a VC, a venture capitalist, so you're not trying to raise money, what do vanity metrics actually do? Like, what am I trying to do? I get the idea of lead magnets, right? Because some of them would probably translate to
sales. You
know, exactly, to sales or maybe potential readers. But for us, that was never the objective. We just want to make sure that we build a community that really trusts us as a brand. Right? So we didn't want to do any of this. In fact, even the podcast, if you go on our website, you'll not see a mention of the podcast. The only way for you to find the podcast is to actually go on Apple and probably or Spotify and find the podcast themselves.
Yeah, it's also very hard, I'd say, on both websites, Ditto and FinShots, to find the about section.
Exactly.
It's designed in a way like that.
It's done in such a way that if you like the product, right, you can subscribe to the service and that's it. That's about it. I'm not going to try and spam you. I'm not going to try and harass you. I'm not going to elicit information from you just because I could probably use it in the future. And this business of trust, right? Like you said, if you pitch to a marketer, if you pitch it to a business person, any entrepreneur, they'll laugh at it, they'll scoff at it. Luckily for us, we were under the tutelage of Zerodha, for instance.
Okay. Right?
Zerodha somehow built a very, very successful business on the back of doing the right things for customers, which means that they weren't inducing people to trade, right? They weren't trying to, in fact, they were dissuading people. When they invested in us, one of the things that they wanted to do was they saw that a lot of people lost a lot of money trading. And so they believed a better alternative for these people is to become long-term investors. But they also believed that to do that, they have to have good advisors. And so they wanted to build an advisory platform. Uh-huh. And they believed we had the right skill set because we had created a content platform before. We were talking about how to go about investing. Uh-huh. And they thought we had the right skill sets. So they invested in us because they didn't want their paying customers to pay anymore because they were losing money. And they believe that this would be beneficial in the long run. And it sounds bonkers, right? It sounds absurd. Mm. I can see your expression as well.
No, I'm just saying, I don't think the Zerodha guy has made any crores with this strategy.
Yeah.
I'm joking, of course.
Of course. That's exactly what somebody would say if they didn't know that they're one of the most profitable companies in India.
Yeah.
Right? It is remarkable what trust can do. And I can speak from my own experience. When we built Ditto, we would go to insurance. Insurance companies are notorious for spam. Uh-huh. Right? They'd spam the hell out of you. You think of an insurance company, if you think of buying insurance, you're going to get 5 people just calling you. Because I'm sure that some of them can, you know, read minds. That's how good they are.
Uh-huh.
Now, when we went to them, we said that, look, we're going to have a website. We're not going to induce people to buy a policy. It's going to be an advisory service. If they want to buy, they can buy it. If they refuse to buy, they say, I do not want to buy, I'm not going to reach out to them anymore. That's it. That's a dead lead for me. I'm not going to talk to them.
So you're not going to say, hey, you added to cart 2 months ago. Would you like to do it again?
No, none of that. Done, right? Our conversations are done. I'm going to leave it at that.
I mean, I'm not even a customer. I feel strangely unmolested by this.
That's exactly the idea that we want to go with. And the insurance companies, again, the only reason why they partnered with us is because we had the Zerodha brand name and they wanted to get, you know, on Zerodha. And they thought this was a way, segue for them to make their way into Zerodha's, you know, platform, Kite, you know, Coin, etc. And they thought that would offer them a good place to market their, you know, products. And that's the only reason why they partnered with us. But at first, thought it was absurd. Now, you see no spam on their websites as well because they realize that doing the right thing can sometimes have long-term benefits, not short-term benefits. Short-term, I'm pretty sure we've foregone a lot of revenue. FinShots has never advertised. For the first 3 years, we made zero revenue. Since we started right out of college in 2018 as a content company, and we started FinShots in 2019. We started Ditto, the insurance advisory platform, in 2021. So from 2018 and 2021, we made zero revenue. Nothing, not a single penny.
I just want to stop you right there and help add some context for me and for people who will watch this.
Yeah.
The context is, okay, I'm sure every person who goes to some kind of a metropolitan college in the country decides they want to do something vaguely in content.
Yeah.
You know, the word is more than a buzzword now. It's a legitimate career.
Yeah.
This
yeah.
blanket term encompasses so many dreams now.
Yeah.
But often what happens is there's either a failure to start.
Yeah.
Or the approach is usually like, you want, at least the way I saw it, is you want to be a big, bad YouTuber with brand deals and whatnot, right? Right. Or you want to go to the OTT route, which involves like slowly climbing up the ladder of, you know, either you do become a lowly media buyer, nothing against media buyers, okay. Or you enter the film route where you're first a production assistant, then somehow you can get to direct.
Correct.
To sort of integrate something that has only been tried successfully in America and UK and elsewhere, where companies like, you know, Morning Brew and so many other newsletter platforms have become so successful.
Yeah.
How did you say, okay, let's do newsletters? And second, did you have formal training as a sharp, clear writer? Because in my humble opinion, I don't think FinShots would have the success it had if the writing wasn't sharp, clear, direct, and also directly valuable to the reader.
Correct. Yeah. You know, I agree. So let me answer the second question first. Any formal training, etc.? Absolutely none. In fact, when I graduated, it was the three of us and eventually another person joined in. So four of us. None of us were writers. None of us had ever written before. I hadn't ever written before. I had done some essay writing when I was in school because my mom wanted to make sure that I participated in every competition, did well everywhere.
Right? I can relate with that.
Yeah. So she wanted me to do classical music, rangoli, flower arrangement, and the occasional essay writing as well. But beyond that, I hadn't done any writing. And this act of writing was an act of desperation for us because originally when we opted out of, you know, placements was a big deal for us, right? So so we had graduated after MBA. We were, most of my batchmates were looking at plush placement opportunities.
I mean, once, that's the secret sauce of going to IIM in the first place.
Exactly.
Right?
Once you go to IIM, you want to make sure that you get a nice plush job, you settle for life, or at least that's the narrative that's peddled. We decided we were going to opt out. And once we opted out, we said that we were going to build a stockbroking platform just like Zerodha. But naivety when it comes to entrepreneurship is so high. Often, you know, in young entrepreneurs, that we thought we could just get away with it. We just thought, you know, we'll raise some money, we'll get the broking license, we just build the platform. You know, who says no? And then we quickly realized, well, the regulator says no, right? It's very hard to get a license. And then you realize that, you know, the capital investments required, the capitalists who are going to fund you are looking at you and saying, you have no experience and you don't have the vision. We didn't have the vision at that time. I mean, we had a pitch deck at best. And so we couldn't do what we originally envisioned, which is build a stockbroking platform. And as an act of desperation, because we've now sort of made our bed, we have to sleep in it. We've opted out of placements. We had about 2 years to experiment. And if it didn't work out, we were going to be off stipends. The college had graciously offered us a stipend to persist with this program. And if it didn't work out, we had to go back or we had to do something else. And so we had a two-year window. And within those 2 years, we had to figure out something. And so after about 4 or 5 months, we realized the only thing that we can do right now is content because no capital investment. I mean, we could do it from a room right now, right?
Yeah.
I could pick up my phone and I could start recording and I could become a content
creator. Hey guys, welcome to my startup.
Exactly. And you could do that. I was seeing this excellent creator on Instagram. He was starting this series on how to start a Vadapav stall.
Okay.
Right? I've been fascinated with this guy. He's already 10,000 followers. He's only started, maybe a week. And it's fascinating how little you need to sort of start, doing content. And so we could do it as well. We could write. And we saw who was best suited to write. And I realized I probably was best suited because I did have a habit of reading stuff. And so I thought I'd write. So it was a complete accident. But complete accident. Mm. I realized that I did have a knack for writing. I did have a knack for simplifying things.
I want to stop you right there again.
Okay.
So I've read your Finshots from 2020, 2021.
Yeah.
And I've read the recent ones, the ones you wrote the last few days and in March.
Yeah.
These are very short,
right? Yeah.
Those are a little bit longer.
Yeah.
Now, you come from a CBSE school, ICSE school or?
No, state.
State school, state, right?
Yeah.
So, I'm not sure what it is like here. Yeah. I went from a CBSE school.
Yeah.
My English writing was very stunted.
They
taught me how to be adjective driven. I couldn't form logical sentences.
Yeah.
Like, this is my thesis. These are supporting points, antithesis, conclusion, none of that. So it's just like sentence after sentence, you get graded for polish and finesse and elegance, but no real logic or clarity, which is sort of the bedrock of Hemingway style American writing that most business writing today is governed by.
Yeah.
So you come from state school background.
Yeah.
What kind of tools, platforms, mentors, coaches you use to then equip yourself to start writing the FinShot style?
I'll be honest with you, nothing. But I can tell you what probably helped me get to where I was when it comes to sort of, you know, financial business writing. So I used to be a teacher. So I graduated as an engineer. Mm-hmm. And again, I opted out of placements. I didn't want to, you know, become, I had a degree in computer science, which again, I couldn't write a line of code to save my life, right? I'm terrible at it. So I thought I'd have to do something else. And eventually I ended up as a teacher in a coaching institute.
For what?
For Time. You know Time, CAT Coaching Institute.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so I started teaching. I'd never taken CAT before, but I started teaching CAT students because I was decent at math. So I thought, okay, I could do this. And my first few classes, I was teaching bank PO aspirants. And these exams are not as hard. I mean, when you compare it to CAT at least. But it was baptism by fire because a lot of these people would look at a 21-year-old and these are 26, 27, 30-year-olds. Mm. You know, and they'd be like, am I paying my money for this? Right? Did they complain?
Did they complain ever?
Yeah, first few classes, I think there were a few complaints, right? Because there were hardly about 8 people. And then, you know, there were 4 people turning up the next day. So that was difficult for me. And slowly but surely, I realized that I had to become a better teacher if I was going to stay here. That was my first job. I was paid a very, very modest salary, but I really wanted to make a mark. I didn't want to be laid off, you know? So I thought, okay, fine, let me get better at it. And I realized what I needed to do. And one of the ideas that I sort of stumbled on, and I'm pretty sure most people would stumble on this idea themselves, is that when I'd go and solve a problem, right, a math problem, I'd look at the sheet the previous day. I'd solve the problems because I want to make sure that I don't fumble in class. That'd be embarrassing, you know, for a teacher to not know how to solve a problem. So I'd solve it the previous night and I'd know how to solve it. So the next day I'd go, okay, do step 1, step 2, step 3, step 4, like an algorithm, right? These 4 steps, you get the answer, right? I'm like, understood? Everybody's like, of course, I follow the steps, I understand. But I realized that's seldom how problems are solved. Like, for instance, if you're playing a game of chess, once the move is made, it's automatically intuitive that was the best move. Like, even an amateur could identify, you know what, that's a pretty good move. Like, even if you've not played a lot of chess, like, you know, you're not a Magnus Carlsen, you can tell, okay, that was a really good move. But before the move is made, there are about, you know, millions of combinations that you have to parse. Maybe a few million combinations that you have to just look at. Just look at and see, keep what's the best combination to play, to parse through all the moves. You have to whittle it down. And then you'll probably get one move that stands out, right? So there's this process, this journey of trying to identify what the best move is. And in math, it's a similar journey that most people, any individual who solved a hard math problem, they work out, they go a certain path, they realize, that's not it. Another path, maybe not. And then they realize, okay, fine, this did not work, maybe this will work, right? And so I realized it's not the destination that matters, it's the journey that matters. So to make my classes interesting, I'd go on the journey. I tell them, let's solve it this way. And then I'd say, oh, they are a dead end. Now we can't do much. And then we'd go back and we'd be like, okay, let's try and figure out something else. So this journey of exploration helped a lot of my students understand the logic behind why you approached it this way and not the other way. Because there are many combinations you can go with. And I used the same principle when I began to write as well. Because, you know, business writing is precise. But it's precise in a very... very off-putting sense. And I'll tell you what I mean by that. If I told you exactly today, this stock price, you know, this stock moved this much because there is this thesis, right? And I put it down, great, you're done with the story.
Mm-hmm.
But if I explored 5 different ideas, right, that other people have explored remotely, and I told you, okay, you know what, this doesn't make sense because of this, this makes sense because of this, you get a much better understanding of the subject. So oftentimes, when I write stories, I'd follow this principle. And one of the best examples that I can think of was a story that I wrote when oil futures broke the $0 mark. Essentially, in layman terms, what that means is you could buy oil futures for negative $32.
Okay.
Like that doesn't make intuitive sense. Like
so what that I would get $32.
Yes, yes.
I would assume that.
Right? Yes, yes. Right? For buying, you know.
For buying oil, yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't make sense. And it didn't make sense to me as well because, you know, I struggled with finance back in college as well. So I'd use the same idea. I'd have to rework, you know. And some of my peers, my partners, my batchmates, much smarter than me, they'd figure it out because they were intuitively equipped to understand what was happening. Whereas me, I couldn't. I had to figure it out. I had to break it down. I really had to struggle. I had to go down this path of, you know, parsing through many combinations, finally figuring out what works. So I said, okay, here's what I'm going to do. Instead of telling you exactly what happened with oil, I'm going to assume that I'm a trader 1 year ago making this bet on this future, and I'm going to chart my path until this day. Like everything that I would have felt emotionally, right, or financially, every decision that I would have made over the course, every bit of research that I would have done as a trader to see what my outcome would be if I held this future, you know, until expiry, right? Which essentially would mean that I would have to basically pay somebody to sell oil, right? And so I drew out this, you know, entire story as if I'm a trader. And through the course of that journey, I learned so much about how oil futures are traded. And if, for instance, the contracts, you know, at the end of expiry, you have to take physical delivery. So sometimes, you know, these contracts usually are financial contracts. But they're actually, occasionally, there's somebody who's actually looking to buy the physical commodities as well, like the actual oil. Right? So I'm like, okay, if I were to buy a physical commodity, how would it work? Like 1,000 barrels of oil, because that's how the standardized contracts work. Where would I put them? And if I put them in my backyard, what happens? Can I put them in my backyard? And so it was a process of just journey of figuring out exactly what would happen if I was a trader. And that story was one of the best stories that we did, because people were like, wow, I've never read something like this. And that's a principle that I used over and over again when it comes to writing. And you know, back in the same time, another story that I wrote was about boycotting China. There was this big narrative about boycotting Chinese products, etc. And I knew the sentiment of the time, right? Everybody wanted to boycott China, and you could understand it, right? Because there was the transgressions at the border, and we felt like we had to, you know, have a response. And completely understandable. That's how exactly I felt as well. However, it was a suboptimal economic move in some sense, right? Because China, for instance, to produce, you know, a chemical, you know, say a barrel of chemicals, I'm not going to name some chemical, has to have highly polluting plants, you know, massive, you know, ecological impact. And then they ship to India, they buy, you know, that pays a certain price for it, but does not pay the ecological cost for it.
We don't pay the ecological cost.
We don't
cost.
Pay ecological because they're polluting in China. Uh-huh. Let them pollute in China, right? We don't bear the burden. So there are multiple things that you have to think of, right? So I'm like, okay, how do I make this more interesting? So the title of the story was not why we shouldn't boycott China. It was what is the best way to boycott China? You see, and now suddenly I'm giving you ideas on how to actually boycott China. One of the better ways to probably boycott China is self-dependence, like in the sense that self-sustenance. For instance, if we could incentivize certain industries in India, right, PLI, production linked incentives, that's an excellent scheme that incentivizes people to set up manufacturing facilities here. You could actually boycott China by virtue of having locally sourced products. Right? Because now there's cost competitiveness. If we scale this, right, we could perhaps at some point become competitive with China. We're not there yet. But that's a good path to take. At least I can see how that's a better way to boycott China as opposed to simply saying, I'm not going to buy from, you know.
Yeah, because you lose out on so much money as a result.
On so much money and trade gets impacted. You know, small MSME guy, you know, in Gujarat, for instance, who's shipping toys from China, suddenly is impacted by this move that cripples the MSME industries. Like, you see, if consumers boycott China, it's not just, you know, China getting affected. It's, you know, local manufacturers as well. And so the approach of storytelling, I think, evolved from my lack of intuitive understanding of things. I struggle with it. I have to break it down internally. I really have to think.
Yeah, right? Especially because these things are, let's just say, reserved for the experts.
Yeah.
You would
yeah.
have to be an expert in every single one of these things
yeah.
at all times in your life.
Exactly.
To then explain it to the layman. So exactly. you basically do a long form research.
Yeah.
And instead of condensing it, you show your thinking through the writing.
Exactly. And doing that was, again, you know, at first I wasn't very good at it, but I'd done this, you know, in 2018 when we had a few thousand readers, for instance, right? So there was a brand called Finception, and we do long form storytelling, and I use the same principles there as well. And so I'd gotten better at it. It was, you know, I'd practiced for a year, so I was slowly getting better. By the time FinShots came out,
and what's the frequency?
So back then it was once a week, but with FinShots it was once a day. And starting off, we didn't have writers. It was just me and another guy who'd help me with a little bit of research. So I'd sit at 3 o'clock every, because until three I'd work on other things. We were also building other things, you know, trying to make money, because there's no money in FinShots. And so three I'd sit, I'd write till 9, And then, you know, by about 10 or 10:15, we'd
ship it.
Yeah, we'd probably be ready to ship it, right? So 6 hours I just spent.
But that must be so fun.
It was fun and it was tiring. I used to call it, it's like Vikram and Betal. I felt like Betal. You can't get rid of it. You can't be sick.
Oh, because you're on the production cycle.
It's a cycle every day.
You were like a factory worker in China.
Exactly.
But for content creation.
For content creation. And I try and get other writers to do what I did, but it never come out the same. And as a small brand, now, you know, now we have the luxury to experiment with things. But back then, we had to make sure that the content was on point. And this skill, this intuitive, like I said, lack of intuitive understanding thereby making me go around this path, it's very hard to teach, I found, right? Mm-hmm. It was very hard for others to sort of understand what I was doing. And so I had to write every single day. In fact, when COVID came around, I had to take a break because my dad was hospitalized and there were a few other who was hospitalized as well. The only solution for FinShots was we had to shut FinShots for 1.5 weeks. We didn't publish anything. That's how, you know, bad it was. I was the USP, I was the bottleneck as well when we were building FinShots. And I wanted to make sure that I get rid of this, right? I get rid of the FinShots thing, writing, editing. And eventually it did happen. But yeah, those first couple of years it was fun. It was a lot of learning because you get to learn so many things that you never thought of, right?
I have so much to say and ask about this. So allow me the time to do that.
Yeah.
Number one probably is, so I'll take it in this way. I read the Soho House story.
Okay.
As a recent entrant to Mumbai.
Yeah.
That place is on my radar as maybe, you know, I should get a membership, whatever. Yeah. I've been there a few times.
Yeah.
It seems like a very, you know, status signal-y thing, but it's also fun. The drinks are amazing, all of those things. So I thought, wow, Soho House story, clearly, am I being targeted? Is FinShots deliberately writing for, you know, the top 1 to 5% consumer? Because I don't think everyone is interested in Soho House. You have to sort of understand what it is. And it was a quick, clever little quip about Meghan Markle meeting, you know, Prince Harry, which I did not know.
Yeah.
I always thought of it as just a thing that happened.
Yeah,
you know, Soho House just appeared out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And then as the story goes on, you talk about how Soho House is a public company.
Yeah.
And it's in losses.
Yeah.
And by the time I was like, okay, you know, I don't put Soho House on such a high horse.
Yeah.
So I just want to understand, what was the process for that story? And then we'll go on to the other things.
Yeah, so I did not write that story.
Okay.
I've not read that story either, right?
Okay.
Now that I'm this thing. But generally, the idea of every FinShots story, right? So there are three parts to it, right? The first part is context setting. We assume that the reader has no context. And usually that's not the case. Some readers find it repetitive, boring, laborious because they already have the context. But we believe that, you know, somebody who's not, you know, who's completely no idea about you know, Soho House, for instance, we have to set the context. And if the context is interesting, suddenly they're hooked, right? And then there's the meat of the story, what we really want to explain through the storytelling, right?
Hmm.
Because there's always an agenda. Like if we take a position, for instance, right? Let's suppose a story that we did on Sam Altman's the time when he was ousted from the company. Right?
Mm-hmm.
We had to explain what happened and we had to do some context setting about AGI, etc. But once we did that, we had to explain the story of what really happened, right? And we explained a, you know, few theories, etc. So we get there and then finally possible solutions that we look at, right? Why is this happening? What could be the way forward, etc. So these are the three sort of broad guidelines that drive every story. Seems very obvious, right? But oftentimes the difficulty is in connecting these things seamlessly. What you see is three disparate, you know, items in most stories. FinShots, for instance, you know, we weave storytelling such that it doesn't feel like three disparate acts. It feels like one intact story. Right? It's not three disparate acts at all.
Hmm.
So over time, we've realized that this is why readers feel like even if you did not brand FinShots and you put out a story on, say, LinkedIn, and you said, you know, somebody would probably tell, you know, this sounds like FinShots. Because there's a certain way of communicating the story. There's a certain style. And once you evolve this, right, anybody can recognize you. Like they'll know that it's you. Right?
Mm.
And we realize this. And you said we only target the 1 to 5% population. That's precisely true. Right? Because we've always believed that if you're building sort of any service, any business, you have to grow. You have to go from the top down. It can't be, I mean, maybe you can, but we always believe that the better approach is top-down approach. What that means is, when Tesla came about, they started off with the Roadster, the more expensive alternative that nobody could buy, and then they built the more economic variant, right? They use scale, and that's what we think as well. If you want to go down the bottom of the pyramid, you need scale. And to get to that scale, right, you have to make sure you have a lot of resources, a lot of understanding of the market, a lot of learning. So we always believe that for us to do this, we have to target the top 5 to 10%, and then we'll go from there. And building that commerce layer on top was always on our agenda. It's just that FinShorts, we used it as a tool to reach out to the 1-5%, and these 1 to 5% people, right, really appreciate the context setting and the fact that this story is self-contained. They don't have to look up resources. They don't have to Google outside. Everything is self-contained, and it's just 3 minutes. You know, it's not 3 minutes. Actually, it takes about 5 minutes, but it's like Maggie, you know?
Yeah.
You can cook in 2 minutes.
It's a little bit more than 2 minutes, but by the time you're already invested, yeah, you don't care.
You're there, right? You're there.
But that's why I think good writing matters. Because,
it does.
So I have a question about this. So, you know, because you chose finance and contemporary finance stories that also tie into global economics and a little bit of geopolitics, a little bit of like contemporary issues that matter to, like I said, top 5-10%. As a creator, first, if I were to take a more expressive approach, say if I were to start something like a FinShots now, I have a small newsletter that I keep on making defunct and keep on making it active again and again, but I plan to do it full time now. I have a quote from you, and I'm just going to read it out to make things a tad bit easier. Then we'll move on to other stuff. You said, however, newsletters aren't always going to work to your advantage. If you're going down this route, remember your content has to do all the talking. You can't use a personality. Yeah. You can't use a charm. You can't use a whole lot of what comes naturally to you. Mm. Words will have to do your bidding, and it can get difficult at times, which kind of explains why there are more Instagram influencers out there compared to people working on newsletters.
Yeah.
You know, my agents and managers think I'm a very personality-driven creator.
Yeah.
Thankfully, I also happen to be a halfway decent writer.
Right, right.
So what can someone like me do to leverage the full power of newsletters?
Yeah, I think the challenge with newsletters is the consistency of it, right? It's a grind. Writing is a grind. You know, I could probably shoot a podcast right now. For instance, I've done a bit of video creating. I'm not very good at it, but I've dabbled with it, right? So so we create videos for Ditto, you know, and I could probably whip up a video. I could shoot a video in say 30 minutes, right? If I had to write the same piece, that'd be 3-hour grind. No, there's no...
Still, after all these years.
After all these years, it's a 3-hour grind. Because again, you have to write, rewrite, go back, rewrite, write, rewrite, write. This process, any writer will attest to this, right? Any writer who's consistently done this will know that some days words come easy. Some days you're just, you know, in the zone. But there are days when you're just trying to put together a half decent piece.
So you think at that point, even a personality driven content piece could work, because you know FinShots, like until I did not know that you were the co-founder, I wouldn't know that you wrote it.
It isn't
like, you know, it is something about your life per se. It is simply ideas first. Do you think in India, non-idea first and more storytelling centric newsletters could potentially work?
Very hard, right? Because I think when you're doing that, I think video is a better format. I truly believe that. Again, newsletters, I've seen people do well, right? Just by, but there has to be a niche. You have to pick a niche and you have to talk about ideas, because when people read, like I said, nothing else can do your bidding. It has to be the words. Words have to evoke those emotions. And to do that is extremely hard, right? It has to, you know, it's like you're directly talking to the brain. There's nothing else in between. You have to evoke emotions in a certain way that I believe writing can do, but no other medium can do, right? But to do that, it's so hard. It's so extremely hard. And to do it consistently every single day. Some of my stories are crap. Like, I've written stories that are horrible, right? Because I just wasn't feeling it that day, right? And that's what I'm saying. When you're building a newsletter, if you want to make sure that you consistently read it, it shouldn't be a side gig. That's the thing. People think that we did well with commerce, and we've done reasonably well with Ditto, for instance, right? Not as a consequence of us looking at the newsletter as a side gig.
Yeah, or this is my distribution channel, bro.
Yeah, I never thought of it that way. This is my business. We are content creators first. That's our DNA. Even people who've never worked on the writing bit per se still first address ourselves as FinShots creators. We are the people behind FinShots, right?
Is that in your culture document?
It is in our culture document. In fact, even our advisors, insurance advisors, when they send out a message, right? Send out a message saying, hey, I'm Samarth, I'm talking, you know, I'm an insurance advisor. From ditto, buy FinShots, right? Because it's buy FinShots, you know. FinShots is in our DNA. Content creation is in our DNA. It can't be a side gig. I've seen a lot of people who have a great, you know, an Instagram channel, a YouTube channel, and then they want to do this, you know.
On the side.
On the side.
Oh, we also have a newsletter, by the way, that you can subscribe to.
And you're never going to get anything out of it unless, like I said, it's a thing for you. You really have to put resources behind it. And you know, our resources, like I said, as co-founders, we had very limited resources. We probably had about 6-7 employees. So for me to dedicate 6 hours every single day at that point in time when we were making no money, that was a big call. Right? But we felt like that was the right call. Even to this day, my co-founders, like I've gotten to a point where I'm slightly not as happy with FinShots as a brand anymore. Right? I'll be honest with you. I feel like FinShots has lost its touch a little bit. Right? We've probably now stayed to a certain extent. Right? People still love it, but I just have that feeling. And sometimes I debate this, like, should we still keep FinShots? Because we don't get as many leads from the brand anymore. And it's not like a big part of our you know, distribution channel anymore. But then there is this other half of me that knows what FinShots does. Because, you know, even if it's not generating leads today, there's some chap in IIT or there's some girl in an IIM, in some of the top colleges across the country, who's reading it, who knows the name FinShots but has no clue about Ditto. And eventually, if they hear about Ditto and they know that there's this association, there's the, you know, oh, that brand, I love that brand, I love their stories, I love their write. So there's a connect. And suddenly, the commerce bit becomes a lot more easier. When we started off at Ditto, I remember, we were so taken aback by how easy it was for us to sell insurance. Everybody was telling us, this is going to be a nightmare for you. It's a graveyard.
Was it competitive?
It was extremely competitive. Because we had, you know, a giant in Policy Bazaar. It was the OG of the space. Right? They've been in the market for more than a decade. They're a multi-billion dollar business. They're capitalized to a point where, you know, they're swimming in riches at this point. They're profitable as well. And that's our competition. And then you look at the side and all you see is a graveyard. People who've tried and failed. CoverFox, for instance, had raised millions of dollars. Wanted to be an alternative to Policy Bazaar, didn't work out. And then, you know, the founder started ACO as a business. There are other companies that have tried insurance distribution. Paytm has tried insurance distribution, hit and miss. PhonePe is dabbling with insurance distribution. Hmm. And yet, again, they can't seem to get the ball rolling. Right? Tata wants to do insurance distribution. Everybody wants to do insurance distribution. And yet, it seems like nobody can just get it right. And when we started, we were like, man, this isn't so hard. And then we realized why it wasn't hard. Because the first set of buyers, right, the generation one, as we call it, when Ditto was just a brand, there's nothing else. There's no bio. Nobody knows what this company is. FinShots did all the talking. People just buy from us because they love FinShots.
Zero.
Brand. Zero. We didn't spend anything on marketing for the first 6 months. Nothing. And so it was mostly profit. And that's how we became a profitable company. We had raised $5 million from Zerodha, $5 million. In the hopes of building an insurance business because we have accounted for all the marketing costs, etc. And then we're profitable the first year and we're thinking, we're fools. We've raised $5 million. We've diluted all this equity for what? Right? It's a stupid move in hindsight, of course. Right? But at the time, the cushion, the, you know, the support that it extended us, we could do business the way we imagined.
You have revivified my love for writing, I think.
Yeah.
I've come from a very... In the last few years, I've come from a very marketer-centric school.
Right.
Aaj bicho, aaj hi paisa kamao.
Right, right.
That kind of school where people just want to get very short-term customers with their writing. So they write landing pages.
Right.
But they only think about short-term conversions and OTOs. They don't think about a long-term value. Correct. I mean, I did not know that it was pretty easy. I'm sure, you know, building a insurance business is hard as it is.
Yeah.
But the fact that, you know, FinShots covered that CAC for you because they had such a high trust in you. And some of them converted.
And one of the things, you know, I probably misspoke slightly because it was easy because we had spent 3 years just doing FinShots before that. It was like a 3-year marketing campaign that I ran.
Right.
Without expecting
and you also do better. Hiring posts underneath the newsletter still, something I noticed.
Yeah. Now we do it because that's a great place where we get, you know, good advisors.
Uh-huh.
Most of our advisors are very suave. I mean, if you've ever spoken to our advisors, they don't sound like your call center agents, right? Simply because some of these, you know, people come from, you know, the top colleges in India, and insurance advisory is not a glamorous job. It's not the first job you're going to take up right out of college, right? Mm-hmm. But because of Finshots is a brand, again, right, hiring is a lot more easier. These people want to join the brand because they understand the values that we espouse. Right? They've seen the brand evolve. No ads, no nothing. They know, okay, this is a brand I can
do. And good customer service is very rare. Right? Before this, I was at the Blue Tokai in JP Nagar only. And the dude there was so attentive, so nice. I had to say, you're very good at your job.
Right.
And I was wondering, since I was on your website, you kept mentioning no spam and, these people are advisors and not some kind of agents, pushy agents, right? Did you find that this kind of pushiness was the default for the industry? So you then brought about extreme hospitality as the default for your company?
Yeah, I completely agree. Right? Because I think when the OG players came into the market, the problem was price transparency.
Mm-hmm.
Like you never knew what an insurance policy was quoting for, right? With an agent and, on the website or through a different agent. Like you never knew. Policy Bazaar came and formalized everything and immediately prices tanked because now all the prices are there for everyone to see.
So before PB, what was happening? Because, as a very, very layman, when I was preparing for this conversation, I didn't go too much in the depths of what insurance overall represents, right?
Correct.
The field itself.
Right.
Instead, I looked at the players, I looked at the market, and I looked at your brand and a couple of other things.
Yeah.
But when we speak about the before aggregator model, what do you get? Do you get, because I remember as a kid seeing LIC policy Bima ads, right?
Yeah.
And one-off people coming to my house and trying to sell insurance.
Correct.
Was there no unifying body where you could compare prices? Was there no make-my-trip moment?
No.
How was insurance sold before?
Yeah, so Policy Bazaar was the make-my-trip moment, right? And I think this had happened in the US in the 1990s and the same, phenomena, right? Before that, prices were opaque. As a customer, I did not know. I mean, you could quote me a price and I'd take
it. So any charming salesman could sell you any policy.
Any policy, right? And because that's the options I have. Like if you're going to sell me that is it. Right? There's no comparison. There's no nothing.
Hmm.
Right? And suddenly, the aggregator platforms come along and they make prices transparent. Now you can compare prices of different products. And suddenly if you have completely uncompetitive pricing, you have to change your way. How else are you going to sell? If you're marketing your policy at a 60% premium and there's no tangible upside, right, to the customer, mm-hmm. why will they buy a policy from you, right? And suddenly that sort of change happened. But then there was exuberance, right, from insurance aggregators and companies when they realized that, now that the pricing, pricing transparency business is done, let's start pushing, right? Which, insurance has been a traditionally push product, right? You had to push people to think them about security. To this day, we still can't get people to buy term life insurance. Term life insurance is pure life insurance, which means that you die, you get a payout. That's it. No frills attached, no investment component, no money back, no nothing. That's a product that everybody needs to have if you have dependents. If so many families with dependents, my family, my brothers, they have dependents, and yet they refuse to buy a term insurance plan. They completely refuse. They have debt, they have obligations, and God forbid if something were to happen to them, right? Their dependents are going to be in a whole lot of trouble. They say they love them, and yet you see this discrepancy when it comes to buying a term insurance plan because the question always is this: what do I get in return? So it's very hard to sell these products. And as a consequence, a lot of insurance salesmen, agents, etc., resorted to push marketing. They'd call you, they'd harass you, they'd find your number in a database, and they'd never stop. They'd never stop. They'd bully you into buying an insurance policy. And so when we entered the market, we realized we really have no USP. Like, what's a USP? Okay, distribution, etc. Consumers don't care about your distribution.
Yeah. Right? A little pause there.
Yeah.
As a kid, I said, I've seen insurance agents to not be the sales success stories that many would sell them the dream for, right? Yeah. If you become a good insurance agent, maybe you can provide for your family and become star salesman and whatnot.
Yeah.
Instead, I've seen it as a very unglamorous and pushy profession, like you also mentioned.
Correct.
Knowing full well that you've got a, at least if it's not profitable, it's a solid distribution channel, Finshots. Why go from that to something as unglamorous? And frankly, now that I see the website, the UI UX is very cool.
Yeah.
You're a cool dude. You've got a cool studio.
Yeah.
You've made this cool somehow.
Yeah.
But at that point, I'm sure insurance was notoriously uncool, unglamorous, not an exciting thing to work on.
Except there's money to be made.
True money to be made insurance?
Yeah. It's one of the few financial products where agents can still make money. And a lot of people think they shouldn't be making money. which is a fair point. From a consumer point of view, my agent shouldn't be making the kind of money that they're making right now. Yeah, because other financial products, mutual funds, for instance, what do agents make? Pretty much nothing. Hmm. Even the mutual fund companies themselves, you know, they make very little. If you have a, you know, Zerodha, for instance, you know, I mean, they launched their fund house, right? You look at what they're expecting in terms of revenue from the, you know, mutual fund company, and it's not a lot. Right? Financial products, if you are creating the financial product, there's a lot of money to be made. Any financial product, loans, etc., right? But if you're distributing the financial product, there's not a lot of money to be made in most financial products as a distributor, except insurance. Insurance is one of those few places where insurance companies still can't sell the product that they create. For instance, they create a health insurance product and they still have no clue how to sell it, because what is a health insurance policy? A health insurance policy simply says, I'm going to pay for your hospital expenses if you were ever hospitalized. This is commodity at its purest. It's a commodity. My salt is as good as your salt.
Right.
So if Tata has to come and say, my salt is better than all the other salts, there has to be some form of differentiation. And insurance companies have generally struggled to create that differentiation. So now they've ceded that responsibility to agents who do their bidding on behalf of them. Now, as a corporate agent, as an agent who can partner with multiple insurance companies, it is my job to make insurance cool. And if I do that, there is money to be made. So what we're getting at is very simple. Even though it's a very hard, unglamorous, dirty business, and it's very dirty business, let me be honest with you, right? As a consumer, you have to go through the depths of hell to make sure that occasionally, right, to make sure that your claim is processed, even though you're buying the product. It's like buying a fire extinguisher in the hopes that if there's ever a fire, I can use it. And to use it, you have to go through this whole elaborate process. Imagine that, right? You're burning and you're in a hospital bed and you have to figure out how to liaison with claims. And that's where Ditto comes in, and sort of the value we add, and why we can still command the extra commission that we do, right, from insurance companies, because we bring in that value. But put simply, the reason why we ventured into insurance is A, we found a real commerce opportunity there, and B, we realized we had all the ingredients to build a good insurance distribution business. What are those ingredients? First, I told you, distribution is a big problem for insurers, for aggregators, for everyone. We had pre-built distribution. 3 years we had invested in a program, and it has given us good, you know.
And also very parallel to what you wanted to sell.
And simplification. Finance and simplification was a big deal for us. We felt like we could uncomplicate insurance products, right? Because they're dense, they're thick, right? It's very hard for you to read a policy document and make sense of it. So we thought we could do it. In fact, that's one of the first things we did. We read through all the policy documents and we made summaries the same way we do with Finshots. So we had the expertise. And then we also felt that there is an opportunity here, because who are the big insurance distributors online? Outside of Policy Bazaar, you can't name a lot. It's like 90% dominated by one player. So we said, if there's a monopoly in this age and day, in any industry, then that's ripe for disruption. So we felt like, look, there's an opportunity to make a dent here, and we should probably, you know, try and see if we can make a dent. Again, you know, the benefit of having Finshots and the young audience that we cater to, and the hiring issues. I mean, I'm pretty sure we've spoken to Samarth, for instance, before coming here. Samarth was an insurance advisor, started off as an insurance advisor. Again, if you probably would think that he's from the influencer team, he's very suave, the way he speaks, etc. But those are the kind of people that we hire as well, right? So you get that experience. And we thought if we offer that experience, not just while selling, but also when they have to go make a claim, which is a big part of our business, right? I believe we could make a mark, and you know, luckily for us, I think it's worked out decently, this hypothesis.
I was stalking your LinkedIn to understand like what your activities on LinkedIn are. How do you post? Some founders like to post achievements. Some talk about esoteric interests. Some congratulate someone on their work anniversary. You instead are solving people's insurance claims and often providing long clarifications around insurance policies. Now, to give context, what is the IRDAI, and is that of any relevance to insurance buyers at all? And then as an insurance company, because ultimately, since you said you're a corporate insurance agent, you set a plan in motion, you still have to speak with the IRDAI and stuff. Is it an easy organization to work with? Do you think that is there anything that the general public should know about the IRDAI when they make decisions? irrespective of knowing about your brand or the number of insurance providers in the country.
Yeah. I think IRDA, as an organization, right, their job is to be a hard ass.
Okay.
Pardon my language, but their job is to make sure that they are a pain. And the reason is very simple. Insurance industry is notorious for mis-selling.
Right? For what?
For mis-selling products. Okay. Right? Mis-selling. People have sold, my dad was sold a terrible ULIP product, for instance, investment and an insurance plan that he absolutely did not need. Right? And he whiled away a good chunk of his retirement money for that. And that's a story that you'll keep hearing over and over again. People investing in insurance policies and getting suboptimal returns. And sometimes negative returns after investing for 10, 20 years. Right? And they realize that that was a terrible investment.
Negative returns?
Yeah, because they have to surrender a policy and they realize that, you know, they can't simply pay and they don't know the surrender value. They don't know how much they get at the end because the agent has probably missold the idea of a glorious payout at the end. But yeah, I mean, this keeps happening. So as a regulator, the job is extremely hard for them to actually balance consumer interests and insurance companies' interests and walk that path, right? So they're generally very thorough in the way they sort of go about their business, right? So for us, we have to make sure that all our advisors are, you know, compliant in terms of all the regulations. You know, they have to be specified persons, they have to go through training programs, they have to finish the certification, and even insurance companies, right? There are clear guidelines on how they can make payouts, everything, right? The problem for consumers is this. Even though IRDAI has managed to set out guidelines and regulations, code of conduct generally for insurance companies for us, there's a lot of room for interpretation. Let me give you a simple example.
Just like the law.
It's like the law, right? For instance, if you buy an insurance policy right now, you're essentially entering into a standardized contract with the insurance company. This standardized contract can span 50 pages occasionally, right? Nobody has the time to go through 50 pages. So that's where...
They should.
But it's very hard. I mean, nobody will also. Like, for instance, when I bought my first insurance policy, when I was 24, 25, and I had no idea that I'd ever create an insurance distribution company, I ended up buying a health insurance policy. I did not even know the name of the plan. I did not. And that is true. If you go and ask people, what is the name of the plan? They probably name their insurance company. They'll say, it's HDFC Ergo Star.
Mercedes hai mere paas ek. Like how the people say, they can't say the car model, they say the company
Mercedes,
name.
Right? And they'll probably say that at best. Some of them can't even name that. They just say, a mediclaim policy. You know? And then if you probe them further, they probably name the company, but very few people can name the policy themselves. Forget about the contents of the policy.
It's never deemed as important for a consumer to know the...
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because they feel like it's not worth it. But I tell you when it becomes important. Recently, we had a claim of a gentleman. Right? This gentleman bought a health insurance policy. He's 69 years old. He bought a health insurance policy after porting from his previous provider because he wasn't getting a good service from that insurance company. He ported. And 3 months in, he was diagnosed with a heart condition.
Hmm.
The hospital says they want to conduct a bypass surgery. The bypass surgery costs 9 lakhs. That's the quote from one of the top hospitals in the country. This gentleman doesn't have 9 lakhs to pay right now. No money. Now, because he has an insurance policy, he can get a cashless claim processed. Cashless claim essentially means the insurance company will pay on the behalf of the customer. The customer doesn't have to pay anything.
Hmm.
Or at least so the claim. The cashless claim gets triggered, the insurance company begins an investigation. They want to make sure that everything is right.
Right.
The insurance company begins the investigation, and in the course of the investigation, they realize that they may have to do further investigation before they approve the claim. We say, okay, fair enough. This customer calls us because we are his agent, and he says, this is what the insurance company is saying, what should I do now? We get clarity from the insurance company. The insurance company says, we find some discrepancies. They have no obligation to clearly elucidate what discrepancies. There is no obligation on them to actually explain why these discrepancies have to be, or how these discrepancies have to be dealt with. All they have to do is we have to investigate. That's it. And your cashless claim can be in limbo, which means now you have to put up the 9 lakhs.
Of your own money.
Yes. And then you can apply for reimbursement. Reimbursement will be aise hota hai. You go after, let's suppose you put up the 9 lakhs. Let's assume this gentleman had the 9 lakhs, he paid. And then he has to get the claim processed again. He has to reach out to the insurance company, submit all the documents, and they can trigger investigations again. And let's suppose they find even the slightest discrepancy, things that you may not even think of.
So what can be a discrepancy in such a case?
Let me give you an example. In this case, they said that we feel that the customer has deliberately hit this condition while buying the policy in the first place, that he already had a heart condition and that he was not being forthright in his application form. What is the basis for this claim? If the customer asks the insurance company will go file a grievance. Ab grievance file kar do.
But file a grievance with who? IRDAI?
With IRDAI. With IRDAI. Ab IRDAI se pehle you have to file it with the insurance company ka grievance cell and then you go to IRDAI ka ombudsman.
I'm not sure how this will help my heart health in any case.
Exactly. This will make it worse. Because that's what we've seen people. They're desperate. That's why I said you have a burning house and now you have to follow a series of very complicated instructions to make sure that this works. Ab aise product, you tell me who wants to buy, first of all. And this is one of the reasons why agents play such an important role. Because as agents, what we can do, for instance, in the same case, ab discrepancy aa gaya. So hum bolenge ki, we go to the company and we say, ki, what discrepancy? They'll say, we found that this person has hit the condition. So now what I do is, I look at the documents that he submitted. I see that this person has gone to a doctor after he was, once he's bought the policy, 2 months later, he went to a doctor complaining of chest pain. The doctor said, ki, let's do an ECG. ECG mein everything was normal. They saw, ki, okay, they asked him to do a treadmill test. Everything was normal. Kuch nahi aaya. So they sent him back. They didn't suspect anything. The gentleman came again, said, I still have my heart, pain, etc. And that's when they decided to do an angioplasty, which is the gold standard when it comes to finding out if there's a block in the heart. And they found there was a block and, this bypass was suggested. This course of interaction is documented, clearly. This has been documented. As I've explained it to you right now, does it seem like somebody who's been hiding? Like if, say for example, I had already had this condition, do you think I would have gone to a doctor again and got an ECG done? I would have simply told him, mere paas block hai, ab bypass kar lo.
So then my question is it incumbent upon this particular aggrieved customer of the insurance company to show or send scans of all consultation
usko
documents?
Pata bhi nahi hai na. The insurance company will not even say all of this. He doesn't even know what to do. And this is where an agent comes in.
No, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. As an insurance buyer, is it my responsibility to send all consultation documents to my insurance company?
Yes. So
it's my responsibility.
It's your responsibility in the sense that for cashless claim, the hospital only will send it. So they have access to all the documents. They've perused all the documents. Everything that I've said, they've looked at it as well. But their job is to make sure that they don't approve a fraudulent claim. And in the process, the vigilance is so high that they deny legitimate claims also. Ab ye toh bahut legitimate case tha. So we went back to the insurance company and we said, this is the course of events. Please explain in clear writing, where is the discrepancy? If a customer does this, the insurance company can simply say, grievance file kar do. If we say this, what they will do is, I will make sure I investigate it and get back to you. You know why? Simple word, because we have leverage.
Right.
That is it. Because if you start ruining my experience, from tomorrow, I'm not going to sell a single policy. You're done for me.
Your economics relies on me.
Yes. So I have scale, I can leverage my influence. So I go to them and say, you give me a written response. Now, suddenly the junior associate, whatever, doctor, whoever was responsible for the initial rejection, goes to his senior. Ab senior aata hai call pe. Senior looks at it and senior is like, theek hai, ye toh matlab, it probably seems legitimate, but just to confirm, because it's 9 lakh ka claim, we'll send a team there. Now, just to have a conversation.
Actuaries?
With not actuaries. They send a couple of people from their vigilance team or something like that to speak to the client directly, right? So they did that. And now they say, ki, we will finalize this result, whether we'll approve the cashless claim by Wednesday. Surgery to Monday hona hai. We can't wait till Wednesday. Na? So again, we use our leverage, we influence and say, ki, if you do not make sure that you process this claim and you give in clear writing, ki, why you're rejecting it, etc. I'm going to create hell.
Wow, you must have lovely relationships with all these
That's
guys.
That's why it's a dirty business. It is a dirty business. They hate us, we hate them, but we have to love each other as well. We have to work with each other as well, right?
It's a good time in the conversation to bring up Fight Club. The reason I bring up Fight Club is not because I'm a big fan of Edward Norton and Brad Pitt, which I am.
Yeah.
But because in the movie, Edward Norton is what I think an insurance actuary.
Yeah.
And earlier off camera, you were mentioning underwriters, right?
Right.
Simply for clarity's sake, because I get insurance premiums.
Yes.
I get the payout in the end. I get cover. I get liability, risk, damage.
Yeah.
What do these guys do?
All right. So underwriters are people who look at your profile, who look at the premiums that are quoted right? Simply from a consumer point of view. Hmm. They'll see if the application details within the application, your medical history, etc., tallies up to the model that they've created, in the sense that if I'm going to insure your life, it has to match up with the price I'm quoting you right now. I shouldn't end up 5 years later thinking, I've quoted a very low premium and now I can't make money from it, right? So they look at this and they'll see if all your health conditions are in line. If they're not in line, they'll make an assessment of whether they should extend an insurance policy or not, A. And if they're choosing to extend an insurance policy, do you need to pay more money? So from a consumer point of view, when I fill out an application, there'll be somebody poring over the application to see if my medical history is in line with the expectation of the insurance company, if my habits related to smoking, alcohol, etc. are in line with the risks that they're okay taking. And then they'll decide whether you should be insured or not, whether you'll get your application processed or not.
In one case, am I completely uninsurable also? What are some cases where I'd be like, bro, we are not going to give insurance to this guy no matter what?
Yes. So, for instance, let's suppose health insurance. Ab health insurance mein, if you have cancer, if you've been previously diagnosed with cancer, your options are fairly limited when it comes to retail policies. Retail policies are policies that individuals can buy off the shelf. A group policy is a policy where, you know, your employer covers you, or, you know, you're a bank customer, bank says ki all my customers will get a group cover. So those are group covers, right? There these restrictions don't apply. But when it comes to retail policies, if you're going to buy a product off the shelf, then an insurance company will tell you, look, brother, you've already been diagnosed with cancer and we know that you're likely to be, this remission business is not permanent, right? We're probably going to see cancer come back. And if we have to make the payouts, they'll be extravagant. So no amount of premiums that I extract from you can compensate for the losses I may incur in the future. So I'm not going to insure you. Although some companies will tell you, I'll insure you, but with a long set of restrictions.
Okay.
Essentially, I'm saying ki main itna paisa dunga, right? You have to pay 40,000 in premiums or 1 lakh ka cap hai chemotherapy ke liye.
That's it.
I mean, I'm giving an example, but it's fairly restrictive, right? So you don't get comprehensive coverage. So generally, what we recommend as a brand is that if you are young and healthy, now's the best time to actually go and buy a health insurance policy, a retail health insurance policy. Because aage ja ke if you probably contract something, let's suppose I buy a policy today, health insurance policy, 6 years later I'm diagnosed with cancer. Then the insurance company can't come back and say, I'm going to withdraw the policy anymore. Then they'll have to cover you in perpetuity. Right? Every time you pay your premiums on time, they'll have to renew the policy and they'll have to make the payout if you have to make a claim.
Okay.
We've seen cases where people buy the policy within the first year that they're diagnosed with cancer. Bill comes
after buying?
Just within the first year. But policy to issue ho gaya. Uske baad insurance can't say anything, right? Because the assessment of risk was done before. If you had to deny it, you had to deny it then.
Okay.
Right? Unless there was non-disclosure. Somebody is lying, somebody hit the condition and then came about. In fact, one of my friends' father had bought an insurance policy and they'd ported. Basically, they had an insurance policy and they switched their provider. And during switching, they said, I'm fairly healthy. And they were healthy also, right? 4 months later, they were diagnosed with throat cancer. Ab, when they were diagnosed with throat cancer, it just so happened that the treating doctor in the original diagnosis report had said that the patient has been complaining of some trouble swallowing food since the last 4 months. And he had bought the policy after that 4 month ka listing window.
Okay, and right? This is written in pen on a paper.
On the treating, when he submitted a claim, he had to submit the treating doctor ka reports as well. And in the report, the insurer noticed that there was this feature. He was complaining of some problem swallowing karke. Now, this can be classified as non-disclosure. Yes. Because while buying the policy, I did not disclose to the insurance company that I had trouble swallowing, because they'll ask you if you're in good health.
Okay.
And if you say I'm in good health, it generally means you should be in very good health.
Okay. You said buying term insurance earlier.
Okay,
health insurance, right? I'm 27 right now. Got like a shoulder pain,
correct.
Right? I've got the TMJ issue I talked to you about.
Correct.
I will talk about it more a little bit. But generally, all is hunky-dory.
Correct.
Now I go and say, look, I want a health insurance. First of all, my family had one. Now I'm, using my own, because I'm going to have my own family later on in the future. And I also think as an adult, I should have my own. At some point, all of a sudden, one allergy develops after I've mentioned, you know, I realized ki, it's a minor allergy, nothing big.
Yeah.
Is that ground for completely rejecting all my claims?
If you have not disclosed it, then yes, it can be grounds.
Hmm.
It is that strict, right? Even minute things. In this case, the insurer was suggesting that this was not disclosed. However, this bar for non-disclosure is actually, again, slightly grayish.
Hmm.
What the regulator says is that if I have taken a consultation for an issue, then I am supposed to disclose it.
Hmm.
Ab yaar, throat mein kich kich ho raha hai. It can happen to anyone. I'm not going to disclose it. Right?
Do people disclose venereal diseases or no?
I mean, you have to disclose.
Yeah, and yeah. Are insurance, are the underwriters all, are they like, are they careful about people's privacy? For example,
yes,
someone
yeah,
has like
yeah,
sexual
yeah,
issues, right?
Yeah, yeah,
and they have to take a policy.
Yeah.
So in that case, they're a little shy about it.
Yeah, it's a very difficult conversation to have sometimes, because we've seen customers, again, they're not very forthright about these things.
Hmm.
Just to give you an example, I mean, you know, like even hemorrhoids, for instance, right?
Hmm.
People don't want to talk about hemorrhoids, but that is again grounds for non-disclosure if you do not disclose it.
Hmm.
And eventually there's an issue related to, you know, maybe a hemorrhoid removal surgery, right? They can say, well, you did not disclose it, right? And then they can deny your claim. So all of these complications can come up if you are not forthright. But once again, it's not a matter of customers being honest. Oftentimes, I want to be as honest as possible. It may simply slip my mind. Like if I have a small issue with my throat, I may not see enough merit in even disclosing that. Why should I say it? Or let's suppose I have high blood pressure, hypertension. I'm occasionally taking pills. It's under control. I feel like, yeah, why should I even disclose this? What is the point? From an insurer point of view, this is a clear case of non-disclosure. So a lot of customers, by virtue of ignorance alone, end up in a soup. Simply because they do not know what to disclose and what not to disclose. Or they think something is inconsequential. And once they deem it as inconsequential and they choose not to disclose it, eventually it can come back to bite them. Right?
Okay. Okay, let's just say I happen to be of a well-established purchasing power.
Correct.
Thanks to my hard work.
Right.
But in most of India, right, people watching this often, people happen to be in colleges.
Right.
There is the classic stereotype of a broke college student.
Yeah. Yeah.
Purchasing powers aren't as high.
Yeah.
Job markets are always,
yeah,
you know, always bad news.
Yeah.
You never hear about 100,000 jobs available, right? Yeah. That never happens.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm going to think on the Maslow's need hierarchy pyramid, I'm going to think about basic things.
Correct.
I'm going to think about food, water, shelter.
Correct.
After that, I'm going to think about stability, job and all,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
It seems to me in the middle to lower purchasing power, especially as a young person, getting a health insurance is a frivolous, wasteful activity.
Correct.
Right? Uh-huh. Why? So you're saying you should buy it early.
Yeah.
I can't afford it.
Yeah.
My parents can afford it.
Yeah.
So why do I bother? Or even they can't afford it.
The way I see it is very simple. There is this idea of black swans.
Yeah.
Things here that you don't see coming. Right?
Right.
I mean, it's so far-fetched that the likelihood of that happening is so tiny that, again, you do not believe it merits any consideration. Right? And yet, when it happens, it upends everything that you know. Right? I mean, it's almost like it changes the whole paradigm. Right? That's how I think about medical issues in general, right? People mostly don't think about it. It's like something in the rear view mirror, right? Okay, yaar, matlab 21 ho, kya hi ho jayega? And then suddenly you're in an accident, right? You, unfortunately, you're riding a bike on a highway, you slip, you fall, you realize that you have brain trauma, injury, and then you require immediate surgery. The surgery and the added cost alone can add up to 10, 15, 20, 25 lakhs. All of a sudden, your family is in debt. Your savings are all wiped out. You probably have to quit work, so you have no income. If you die and you have dependents, they have no income. So if you have no term insurance policy, you're essentially screwed. Right? And you quickly realize that making a payment worth, say, 10, 15,000 would have alleviated this outcome completely altogether. That's as simple as it is. It's a matter of priorities, I buy, but it's also a matter of practical consideration. If I'm thinking that I can in the next 10 years, I'll never be in a position to put up 20, 25 lakhs upfront, right? Then I should buy a health insurance policy, plain and simple.
Some very smart people in the comments are going to say, but look at the mortality rates decreasing as time goes on.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. So it's like the, based on that very simplistic and flawed notion, I'm still going to say, if mortality rates are decreasing over time and people are like dying at a, you know, they're dying at a more advanced age with modern medicine, I don't think insurance still comes up higher in my...
I completely agree with the argument at all, you know, completely, right? But we also have, like, the people that we talk to, for instance, right? There are people who are still struggling to put up 5,000-10,000, right? But then there are people paying 6,000 on a Netflix account.
That's true as well.
Right? I mean, you're doing it because you feel like, okay, it's entertaining, right? Mm-hmm. It's a need in the sense that it's entertainment. When I look at that, I think that if somebody can put up, like I said, 10,000 a year, right? And it's not a lot of money for somebody who's 25, who's probably earning upwards of a lakh per month, right? If I can put up 10,000 per year, right? Look at all the things that I, like I said, this, once it happens, you may not die, but it will put you in crippling debt. The amount of financial challenges that you will have to suffer, you will have to go through, right? Most Indians are one medical bill away from poverty, from dipping into poverty. That's how bad the situation is. That's how dire the situation is. We've seen people completely... I'll give you a simple example. I've heard of this case right when we were starting our business of a doctor during COVID. Recently married, right? Has a homemaker as a spouse. Unfortunately, during COVID, passes away, right? Leaves a two-month-old child and sort of, you know, the baby and parents, you know, no income, right? This person's cumulative earning potential over the next 60 years would have amounted to close to 6 to 7 crores. Just assuming the basic calculations. That is what he would have earned in his lifetime. Minimum. Right? And yet, what is left for his family? Nothing. They're in debt. They're in immediate debt. Because they bought a house at the time. Right? Crippled for life. They to get out of this cycle of poverty, they'll have to... The kind of financial acrobatics that they'll have to do. Right? And this is the situation in most households in India. And yet we do not think of this eventuality because we are scared of this eventuality. Death is an uncomfortable topic. Health issues are an uncomfortable topic. The C word is banned in my home. If I speak of the word cancer, my mom will shun me. Because they're like, we shouldn't talk about this. We do not talk about the possibilities. Even though I grant you the fact that the likelihood of this happening is very tiny. But if it were to happen, this black swan were to hit your household, most households in India are financially crippled for life. It's a burden that you'll have to bear. Your family will have to bear for life.
And despite what financial influencers would say, people don't actually have so many rainy day funds.
No. Very few people have rainy day. Rainy day funds is an idea. Even if you were to have a rainy day fund of a few lakhs, right? Like I said, one accident, right? Could wipe that all away. If you have a hemorrhage in the brain.
I'll be super honest, you know, we're not even talking about death.
Yeah.
I had a rainy day fund. Yeah. This was like a year and a half ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was completely wiped away because I had to spend money on my TMD treatment that I was telling you about,
exactly,
right?
Exactly.
And it was considered cosmetic.
Yeah.
I know that I had facial pain. I was, you know, struggling, but couldn't ask my parents. Didn't want to ask my parents. Yeah. And that was money I had saved for other things. Yeah. I had to spend all of that.
So that's the financial acrobatics. Now you have to forego a lot of other opportunities. We've seen people forego opportunities to go to business school, you know, or you know, education, pursue future education, because now they have financial bills that they have to take care of. Their dependents are to be taken care of. There's a parent in the household who needs treatment. They don't have, you know, they don't have medical insurance. So I have to constantly work in a job that I do not like. I can't quit. I'm bonded for life because I don't have a health insurance policy.
Tell me something. Do people also use insurance in OPDs or no?
Some people use it, but it's not recommended generally because OPD is a discretionary expense. What that means is, look, if I'm hospitalized for malaria, I can't induce malaria or there's no reason for me to induce malaria. But OPD mein kya hota hai? If I tell you ki I'm going to cover OPD, yaar, I'll go to a dermatologist and I'll get an opinion, consultation. Okay, dermatologist will prescribe, you know, expensive creams, etc., tablets. Khaunga yaar, cover kar denge. So these are discretionary purchases, even though by nature they shouldn't be discretionary. But the insurance companies think that once you offer this benefit, customers will abuse it.
Okay.
Right? So then they say, I'm going to put a cap. So they're going to say, I'm going to offer you OPD benefit, mm-hmm. but it will come with a cap of around, say, 3,000 ka limit. Maximum per year, you can claim. And that 3,000 limit, dene ke liye, usually you'll see that the premiums of that policy will be 3,000 rupees higher. Mm. So that's better left in your pocket and you can use it, you know, right. on a discretionary basis.
I see.
So yeah.
I have a few interesting scenarios.
Yeah.
If I'm a race car driver and I race cars that are even F1 cars.
Yeah.
And I'm an Indian and I go and say, okay, HDFC, whatever company, you know, any company in the world, can you please give me an insurance? Are they going to give me insurance, health insurance?
Term insurance, they know. Health insurance, maybe, right? I mean, depends again.
I'm a race car driver who, in a profession where people routinely get killed.
Yeah, yeah. But
I still want my health to be protected.
Correct.
As I should.
There'll be a debate internally, right? We'll have to see the contours, right? But again, it'll be an underwriter's call, right? By and large, I don't think most insurance companies would be pleased with that kind of profile. But I would believe that there'll be a few people, because health insurance, again, right? There are inbuilt mechanisms to prevent abuse.
Mm.
For instance, there's a clause in a health insurance document, an exclusion, that says, I will not pay for expenses wherever there is hazardous or adventurous activity, sports involved.
Great. So Rishikesh, water rafting, if you die, it's you.
That's it. Or if you are injured, it's you. Death to term insurance, though, you know, you won't get. Life insurance, you won't get. Health insurance, I don't have to pay because this is part of an exclusion.
Okay. So,
right?
Competitive fighters, that my second scenario is already out then.
Right? You're not going to get it. Right? Okay. I mean, it's an exclusion by default. So, wo cover hi nahi hoga.
What if I'm a chain-smoking, pill-popping alcoholic?
Health insurance mil sakta hai.
For despite my three vices.
Only because there's also an exclusion saying ki if you are a chronic alcoholic and if the disease is induced by alcoholism, jaise liver cirrhosis hota hai and the doctor says it's because of alcoholism, then that it is excluded by principle, right? So health insurance de sakta hun, life insurance nahi mil sakta.
Has this business completely skewed your understanding of morality and you know, the tragedy of medical diagnosis, because you see it all through the lens of contracts and constraints?
This is actually a very beautiful question. You know what? I was speaking to somebody recently in an interview and they asked this question. They said ki premiums itna high hai and itna aap exclusions dalte ho, right? Insurance companies are fleecing consumers, right? Which is true. From a consumer point of view, that's exactly what they're doing. And more often than not, like the cases that I described, you need an agent like Ditto to push through, right? Even when you have insurance, right? Even though it helps, even though it is considered a very important financial product that you should own. But there is a general perception that I am being fleeced. And I'm pretty sure when you had the cosmetic thing, aapko bhi, maybe you also thought, itna premium pay karta hun, or you're not going to cover this, right? I have pain. How come you're not going to cover it? But they are a cosmetic procedure. I'm not going to cover it. That is it, plain and simple, right? If we had gone to the ombudsman, we could have made a case that this is medically necessary. There was a chance. But you did not know about it.
No.
Because exactly. You didn't,
I just paid the cost like
exactly,
a fool.
You didn't think too much about it, right? Yeah. We could have made a case. Ki, this is
I'm an Indian
necessary.
Consumer. I protest once or twice, but then I eventually submit.
Exactly. Ab, एक केस बताता हूँ. अब ओरल कैंसर हो गया आपको, ठीक है? डॉक्टर रेकमेंड्स रिकंस्ट्रक्शन सर्जरी. रिकंस्ट्रक्शन भी कॉस्मेटिक होता है ना, बट इंश्योरेंस कंपनीज हैव टू कवर इट बिकॉज द रिकंस्ट्रक्शन इज अ बाय प्रोडक्ट ऑफ अ रियल इलनेस प्रेसिपिटेटेड दैट इज नॉट कॉस्मेटिक इन नेचर एट ऑल.
आई सी.
ठीक है. सो देर आर केसेस वेयर यू कैन फाइट इट आउट एज वेल, बट सम पीपल स्टिल फील कि यार दिस इज जनरली आई फील लाइक दिस इज बीइंग फ्लीस्ड. लेट्स सपोज कि इंश्योरेंस कंपनीज नाउ डिसाइड that I'm going to remove all exclusions. No waiting periods, no nothing. I'm going to make the insurance contract as transparent as possible, right? I'm going to include people like, you know, just say, meko cancer hai. Very, very, people feel like, if you're not going to insure me, who are you going to insure? I mean, it feels, you know, unjust in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
Ki I should be the I should be the kind of person that probably gets insurance and yet I'm not insured. This perception of morality gets warped because you're like, if you're not going to give insurance to me, who are you going to give?
Right.
But what tends to happen is insurance companies don't simply use a mathematics model, are relying on morality. All of a sudden, the burden is borne by the entire customer base. Let me give
you
an example.
I see.
Exactly. So it's not a natural good there.
So you can't do a case-by-case basis. You have to...
Because the costs go up, right? Because if I do a case-by-case underwriting, if I have a personalized contract for you, premiums will shoot up.
So I know what I'm going to say is going to sound like I'm basically asking the government to put up a competitor against your company.
Yeah.
So considering that, you know, despite the best ability and the best efforts of companies like yours to ensure that the customer gets the best deal, if some customers are still fleeced by an XYZ provider, I mean, you're the aggregator, right?
Correct.
Does the government not have a duty to also put up a government-based insurance tool like the way they have done for, say, airlines to prevent like an oligopoly of airlines?
So there is, right? For instance, if you feel that you're an aggrieved customer, if you feel like you've been done wrong by the insurance company, you can first write to the grievance cell of the insurance company and then you can go to the ombudsman. Hmm. The ombudsman works under the purview of
IRDAI. But there is no government insurance provider per se.
But government ka hai na IRDAI. IRDAI is a regulator, again.
But it doesn't provide any insurance policy.
No, they don't provide insurance policy. Saying, yeah. Insurance policy, if the government has to be a provider, even the government knows that it is a loss-making proposition. Okay. It will not make money. Right? Insurance.
But the government loves making loss-making propositions.
There are a lot of state-owned insurance companies that don't make money.
Okay, right? but there are
state-owned insurance companies. But वहाँ पे भी ये problem है. उसको भी इतना loss तो नहीं करना है, because then the sustenance of the business is in question. The sustenance of the business is in question. If I am talking about being a going concern in the future, right? Essentially, then what I have to do is I have to look back and say कि all my customers are in jeopardy now, as a state-owned insurer. If I don't control my losses, if I don't make sure that the numbers add up, so ultimately it all boils down to a mathematical model. Even if it means some people feel aggrieved. Hmm. Ultimately, in some sense at least, you can argue that insurance companies have a lot to fix.
Hmm.
A lot to fix, right? But simply removing these exclusions and doing away with this will not solve the problem, because that will simply push prices higher.
A couple of more questions and we'll wrap this up. As a business owner, my size of business is substantial.
Yeah.
I have a few full-time employees and mostly freelancers now, right? When I see very big companies on LinkedIn offering all kinds of benefits, I often wonder to myself, am I lacking in some way as a business owner? Perhaps should I also offer health benefits?
Yeah.
Or can I give bigger pay?
Right.
And maybe this ties into the history of health benefits in the first place. Why do companies give health insurance? Is it a means to make sure employees stay for longer? Or is there an incentive to do that? I just want to understand that.
After a certain threshold, it's mandatory.
By law?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So if you have a certain number of employees, you have to give health insurance. That's why they do it. And more often than not, companies, in a bid to cut costs, offer you really crappy insurance policies as well. There are companies that do right by you, as in they do offer you policies that are very robust, high coverage, doesn't have a lot of exclusions, etc. But then there are companies that try to fleece you as well. And you won't know it until you actually show up, you know, one day at the doctor and you realize that my insurance company will only let me share in a shared room. And I don't want to share room, you know. So these are things that you won't know until you actually talk to your employer and you see the contract. But generally, they're mandated by law. That's how the government has, in some roundabout way, managed to solve to a certain degree the problem of lack of coverage in India. Because now they're forcing companies to offer. And now the burden of premiums falls on the company itself. And the insurance company, obviously, you know, they try and make sure that the regulations in place standardize certain words. A simple, you know, let's suppose aapka kuch accident ho gaya. Okay. Now, I say ki insurance companies are supposed to cover accidents even if it is in the waiting period.
Waiting period for what?
Usually, when you buy a health insurance policy, there are a few conditions that they will not cover for the first 2 years.
Okay.
The rationale there being ki there are some conditions that are... They manifest slowly. So I can delay treatment. Agar maan lo, let's suppose I have gallbladder stones ka problem. It's not too big of a problem right now. But I've realized I have to get these stones removed someday. So me, being smart, realizes that I can probably apportion this cost to the insurance company. So I go buy a policy. I do not disclose any of this. And then I make a claim within the first 30 days saying ki, yaar, mera stone ho gaya, meko claim de do. So, 50,000 ka procedure for 10,000 ka policy. Scam, right? So, to dissuade people from doing this, they say some condition, right? Some condition that evolves slowly. I'm going to exclude for the first 2 years, right?
Hmm.
But there's also a clause that says all accidents are covered. But accident ka exact definition kya hai? Main tennis khel raha hu, okay? I hurt my knee. Is that an accident or is it not? So IRDAI in its wisdom has come out and standardized a lot of these terms. They've said iska meaning ye hai. So you can't go back and say ki I made up my own definition because ispe bhi bahut khelte the, right? So IRDAI is doing a lot to make sure that the consumers aren't as aggrieved as they used to be, at least, right? Now there are standardization, you know, even ombudsman, etc. There's a clear pathway to communicating with the ombudsman, representing your case. And the ombudsman is consistently ruled with the consumer, right? They don't take the insurer's side, vaise. So there is big work being done, but then again, I think it's a journey, right? I don't think, because private insurance companies only started making big strides in the last, say, 10, 15 years. It's a very sort of nascent industry market, right? Where competition has spurred a lot of innovation. Our competition has forced us to treat customers nicely. Because nobody else was doing it, I've been forced to do it now.
Right.
And that's again being spurred by private competition, etc. Right. So I believe that as, you know, and you know, 10 years back, the policies were so crappy for such high premiums. Now the prices have come down, offers better features. You don't have restrictions, fewer restrictions, standardization of terms. So I think in the next 5 to 10 years, we will get to a point where I think the standardization will be such that the room for interpretation diminishes and customers don't feel like they've been hard done by the insurance company, right?
Yeah, ideally you would want the lawyers and the legalese to stay out of this so people can actually get treated. Because the ultimate, of course, you know, charge a premium and very well make money, but the ultimate goal is to make sure that the people are able to fix their diseases or to be able to help their dependents, right? That's generally the idea. One absurd statement that I want to make and then, you know, we'll wrap this up is, I have a old 2005 Ripley's Believe It or Not that I purchased.
Okay.
And it said that I think Beyonce has had her legs insured.
Right.
Does Ditto cover weird insurances like that?
No. So we generally purvey, you know, standardized contracts, which means that insurance companies have a bunch of policies, standardized policies for a large customer base, and we sell those policies. Now, the problem is facilitating these very specialized contracts is that you have to get legalese involved there, right? Because there is no standardization, everything has to be custom made, the costs go up. And there are very few people in India who would actually...
But people, do you know people who do specialized insurances? Any weird instances that strike out to you?
Yeah. I mean, I've heard that again. I've never sort of gone in and dug around to see if it's true. But I've known Messi's left leg is insured, for instance.
Yes, I know about that as well.
I've heard of, you know, teeth being insured, right? Of certain boxer, I don't remember the name, right? And so I've heard of weird insurance policies. Pet insurance is a big thing now. Right? It's because you know, pet parents want to make sure that their pets are taken care of, and you know, sometimes these costs can add up very quickly. Right? A simple trip to the veterinary hospital could be as
damaging. It is very expensive. As someone who recently transported 2 cats across countries, very, very expensive.
So pet insurance has been big demand, right, from customers. But very, very few companies are still sort of, look, for insurance to make sense, you have to have a large subscriber base. Lot of people should subscribe to that insurance.
How many people in India do you think would have insurances?
Depends, like health insurance, a proper contract, I think less than 10%.
Of the population?
Yeah, less than 10%.
If we were to make the population 140 crore, so 12 to 15 crore.
Yeah. I mean, there are, you know, like for instance...
And this is a rough estimate. This is not, we're not looking at statistics at all.
No. This is very rough estimates. And I'm basing this off, you know, of the fact that there's also corporate insurance, etc. Right? There's state-backed insurance companies. So some states you'll see that there's 100% coverage, because you'll get, you know, maybe 1 lakh worth of protection from the, you know,
from the state government.
Yeah, from certain state governments. Yeah, they're fully insured, right? Or they'll give you some protection.
That's very cool.
Yeah. Some state governments do it. We also have, you know, policies for people below the poverty line. Right, which again, very modest premiums that you have to pay, some 20, 30 rupees, I think, right? And you get coverage of up to 20 lakhs, right? 2 lakhs. Okay. 2 lakhs. So you do have pockets where there is insurance coverage, but what we want to generally look at is optimum coverage, which is, are you covered enough to make sure that it doesn't completely upend your life? Like 2 lakhs will, probably help. But if my bill is 10 lakhs, it's really drop in the bucket.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm trying to look at, is in India insured enough, right? And if you look at that population, then that's less than 2%.
Right? Wow.
Probably, yeah. Probably.
Everyone else is just free soloing it.
They're probably taking a big gamble, right? And I think it's not just with health, right? Health, okay. But it boggles my mind that when it comes to life insurance, term life insurance, and I used to think of this, it is a wasteful expense. Like, why am I paying 10,000? And if I live till 65, I don't get anything. Kuch nahi, I paid, my premiums. But the alternate version of that is, what if something were to happen to me and I have my dependent parents to be taken care of? My spouse. And they're my life, right? If I'm not around and they're in trouble, that would be really, really bad. Really bad. That's an eventuality that I would want to avoid at all costs. You ask this to anybody who has dependent parents or dependent spouse, and they'll answer this. They'll say, I'll do anything for them. And you say, well, all you have to do is buy a term insurance policy. Wo to yaar. Which is very hard for me to
say. I would write a dubious will instead of giving them term insurance.
Yeah.
Thank you, man. Thank you for this. And I never expected to get such a comprehensive masterclass into all things insurance and writing online. I have certainly lacked in the insurance area myself, let me tell you. Came in fully ignorantly. And I think I will now look at who my provider is to start with.
Also your agent, yeah?
And my agent, yes. and hopefully see what I can do about it. Because, like I said, I considered it to be something that my parents took care of. And now I have to. But despite being generally health-centric, there is no guarantee that things are always as they seem to be. And thank you for being so precise about these things. And hopefully, agar jo log dekh rahe hain, if they're interested in insurance, they can check out Ditto and they can check out your work and convince themselves. Even if you read Finfin Shops, you'll see it's in the bottom text. Yeah, I had a great time. Thank you for coming to my office and doing this.
I'm glad to be. This is a very nice office, huh?
Just got an investment, so, figured might as well build a good office.
It's a nice kind of competition.
You got this from Italy, by the way.
Italy.
Yeah, very expensive. Yeah.
Well, what is it?
It's called, I'm making this up as I go along.
Of course, I know. I'm trying to figure out if you're going to say it's some...
No, I lost count. Yeah. I couldn't figure where to go. Anyway, man, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Yeah.